my accent 40 years ago. Yes. And she said, so your English is not perfect, but you have interesting message, and I want my audience to hear your message. And she said something that became almost like an 11th commandment for me. She said, Edward, perfection is not the issue. Perfect is the enemy of the good. And she wanted me to do a program at the end of All Things Considered, major news program, once per week. Great story I wanted to tell. I had to just have 500 or 600 words. So I learned to edit myself.
Well, on that note, Edward Goldman, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
My pleasure, John. I look forward to more conversation with you.
Me too. If you like what you hear on KPFK, you can become a member, and that way you can participate in KPFK's future and vote in the upcoming KPFK election. Even better, become a sustaining member by making a regular monthly contribution. Look at our website, kpfk.org, for more information. This is John Crumshaw for KPFK, Politics or Pedagogy.
Hi, I'm Margaret Cho. You're listening to KPFK, listener-sponsored radio. Public radio is important because it's so much better than private radio. Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. The United States is the world's biggest weapons exporter, accounting for 40% of the global weapons industry. Now, there are two ways in which a foreign state can procure American weapons, either direct commercial sales or through foreign military financing. Through direct commercial sales, foreign states may negotiate weapons contracts directly from American arms companies, and these contracts must then be approved by the State Department. On the other hand, through foreign military financing, the United States issues monetary grants to foreign militaries for the purchase of U.S. defense equipment, training, and services. Simply put, while direct commercial sales are paid for through the defense budget of a foreign country, foreign military financing allocates American funds to foreign governments for the purpose of purchasing American weapons. Now, foreign military financing is the current framework for government-to-government weapons transfers established by the Arms Export Control Act of 1976. However, there is one exception to the foreign military financing program's provisions: Israel's arms industry. Foreign military financing must be used exclusively to procure U.S. military equipment and training for all states except Israel, which may use a portion of the funds for research, development, and procurement of advanced weapons systems. Now, in the 1980s, American military aid to Israel began incorporating an offshore procurement clause, meaning that unlike all other foreign military financing, the funds to Israel were not earmarked solely for purchasing American weapons, but could be used by Israel for domestic development and production as well. Israel receives $3.3 billion in foreign military financing from the United States every year, which is more than every other state in the world receives combined. American foreign military financing finances upwards of 16% of Israel's total annual defense budget. About 75% of this aid is earmarked for the purchase of American weapons, while 25% of the funds are used for research and development of Israeli-made weapons. And so, through the unconditional support of the United States, Israel has become the 10th biggest arms exporter of the world, selling weapons to at least 130 countries. In his new book, The Palestine Laboratory: How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World, Anthony Lowenstein uncovers how Israel has used the occupied Palestinians as the ultimate guinea pigs when developing its weapons and tools of repression that is now being sold all over the world, contributing to global violence, destruction, and global insecurity. With us today to talk about how Israel has become the 10th biggest arms exporter in the world through the unconditional support of the United States, testing its weapons on occupied Palestinians, is our guest, Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony Lowenstein is an independent journalist, best-selling author, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. He's written for The Guardian, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and many others. His latest book, as I mentioned in my intro, is The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. His other books include Pills, Powder, and Smoke, Disaster Capitalism, and My Israel Question. His documentary films include Disaster Capitalism and the Al Jazeera English films West Africa's Opioid Crisis and Under the Cover of COVID. He was based in East Jerusalem from 2016 to 2020. Anthony Lowenstein, welcome to Middle East in Focus.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am very honored and excited to be talking with you today. I think your book is incredibly important. And I, you know, before we get into the specifics within your book and the recent articles that you've put out, can you first talk about why you felt it was crucial to write and release this book entitled The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World?
When I was living in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020, I guess I was looking around for a narrative as a journalist that was not just about the conflict itself, not to minimize the importance of writing about what's happening every day in the West Bank or Gaza or East Jerusalem, which is brutal in its own way. But I guess there started to be a lot of reporting around Pegasus, the Israeli spyware, which I know we'll talk about later, and how that was proliferating around the world. It was appearing in God knows how many countries across the planet. And it sort of became clear to me that as a journalist who'd spent quite a lot of time reporting on different conflicts, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Honduras, all those conflicts are brutal and terrible in their own way, but they're geographically fairly based in those areas. What I started looking into and thinking about and reporting on was how the occupation of Palestine was not staying there. The occupation of Palestine was horrible on its own way, but it was also being exported around the world. And I couldn't think of that many other conflicts where that was happening. And it seemed to me an area that was not getting much media attention and deserved to have some.
And were you surprised about, with respect to how little people knew about the way in which the occupation, as you put it, was being exported around the world?
People are still shocked now. My book has just come out around the world and I talk to people quite a lot, friends and in the media too. And people are either shocked, they're appalled, they're often skeptical at first before you explain to them what that means and why it's so important to understand what Israel is doing, because it gives it Israel, in many ways, in my view, an insurance policy of sorts. You know, years ago, with the end of apartheid South Africa in 1994, by the end of its life, virtually the entire world was turned against South Africa. Although, interestingly enough, as I talk about in the book, Israel was a friend right till the end, which I think is revealing about how they viewed each other ideologically. But Israel does not want to suffer the same fate. And by selling so much defense equipment, weapons, spyware, whatever it may be, to so many countries, I think Israel believes, and potentially in the short to medium term with some justification, that it can insulate itself from any political headwinds that might come against it, because so many nations want and need, in their view, Israeli weapons or defense equipment to repress their own peoples, their own minorities, their own journalists, etc. So, yeah, I thought it was something that people need to hear about, and if they're shocked, so be it.
You know, as you importantly state now and in your work, you know, it is really important to understand Israel in relation to how it's actually contributing to global insecurity and violence. And I want to get into the specifics around the way it's doing that in terms of exporting weapons and tools of repression. But before we go into the specifics around the weapons and tools of repression that it's exporting, can you discuss how Israel actually also exports its method of creating this sort of fictional enemy narrative to justify its apartheid policies and its further development of dangerous tools for repression and violence globally?
A lot of what Israel is doing started soon after 1948, so Israel's birth. And so for between 48 and 67, of course, there was a different form of occupation against Palestinians. And the Israeli arms industry really started gearing up for more global sales when David Ben-Gurion was Israel's first prime minister. But things really accelerated after 1967. And the reason for that is, that's, of course, the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. And the reason for that is that Israel was starting to say that they had invaluable counterinsurgency experience, that they had day-to-day, 24/7 experience of controlling an enemy population. That's essentially how they viewed it, how they described it. And as I talk about in the book, there were so many countries around the world, from repressive regimes in Latin and South America in the 70s and 80s and far beyond, that looked to Israel's experience and said, we want to have some of that experience in our own country. We want to also repress our own minority or whatever group it may be. So you have Israeli officials, both state officials but also private elements that worked for the state, openly talking about wanting to take what Israel's learning in the West Bank and Gaza and exporting that. You have repressive regimes in Latin and South America openly talking, as I extensively show in the book, in the 70s and 80s about wanting to get a piece of what Israel is doing. Israel was aware from pretty early on after 1967 that many countries around the world didn't like what it was doing, didn't approve the occupation. In fact, they opposed it. But, and of course, back then that was the middle of the Cold War. So there was the, in a very simplistic way, the US was on one side and the Soviets were on the other side. It was a bit more complicated than that, but that was the general view. But what Israel did to try to, I guess, propel its own, not just existence, but its own experience, was to openly discuss how other nations could learn from Israel's experience. So, for example, in the early 1980s, Guatemala, as one example among so many, was committing literally genocide against its indigenous population. And you have media reports back then, which I quote in the book, of Israel assisting that. I'm not saying they were assisting in the actual killing, but they were assisting in the training of the Guatemalans, of involved in training death squads in Guatemala. And there are so many other examples of this. And it seems to me that if there's ever, as there should be, some kind of legitimate war crimes tribunals around so many conflicts around the world, of which Guatemala should be one, Israel's going to be in the dock for that, because, in fact, if for no other reason than the evidence for their involvement, A, is incredibly clear. It's not like it's even that hidden. They were selling weapons, they were selling arms. And it seems that a lot of these nations, although maybe at times they were publicly opposed to what Israel was doing, often Israel was befriending these nations to get certain votes in the UN. That's often how it worked in the past, but also today. So that kind of very, it's not even a question of real politique. It's just, I mean, the arms industry, of course, is amoral by definition. I mean, the US arms industry is not based on any kind of morality either. But Israel has a ready-made occupied population in its backyard and was using that experience to promote itself around the world.
You bring up an interesting point and about the issue being held accountable legally for war crimes. So, and again, excuse me if I'm putting you on the spot with this question, but can, so obviously, it, you know, it many have talked about Israel needing to be held accountable for war crimes committed against Palestinians. Is it your belief that Israel should and could be held legally accountable for war crimes committed in other countries because of Israel's arms industry and export and exporting of its arms and global insecurity and violence?
I mean, the short answer is yes, it could be. And what really is missing at the moment, of course, is the political will, right? I mean, Israel is the ultimate state of impunity. There is no real international pressure to hold Israel to account. I'm not belittling the BDS movement, for example, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, but there is no current real movement to have Israeli generals, prime ministers, defense officials in the International Criminal Court. I mean, it's currently unimaginable that would happen. I mean, it's impossible to imagine American officials there either. But absolutely, for example, in Guatemala, to go back to that for a moment, there was an international UN report that detailed the genocide in Guatemala. Israel was listed and named very openly as being complicit in that. They weren't the sole role, of course, but they had a role. And if there was some kind of momentum to hold Israel to account, Israeli officials, the ones that were alive at least, could most definitely be held to account for that. I mean, they were literally assisting a genocidal regime in the 1980s. So again, it comes to the same issue, doesn't it? That the lack of accountability for Israeli crimes is a central reason why it keeps on going, because frankly, nobody, or very few, in the international arena really want to hold Israel to account. And I would argue because so many of them are so desperate for Israeli surveillance tech, repressive tech, whatever it may be. And that to me is part of the problem.
Well, and speaking of, you know, the lack of accountability by other nations, one of the nations that not only refuses to hold Israel accountable, but unconditionally supports Israel, and in fact, one could argue actually mentors Israel in becoming this this exporter of arms and violence and global insecurity, is the United States. Now, so we have to now talk about the U.S. and the U.S.'s role in all of this. Now, with the U.S. still being, as I talked about in my opening, the leading exporter of arms globally, accounting for 40% of the global weapons industry, can you discuss how the U.S. has enabled Israel in becoming the 10th biggest arms exporter in the world, using, as you state, quote, occupied Palestinians as the ultimate guinea pigs, end quote, when developing its weapons?
So the U.S., of course, was an Israeli ally from day one, from 1948. But that friendship really hugely accelerated after 1967. And by the time you get to the 1970s and 80s, what you find is in many countries around the world, two things. You find either the U.S. and Israel working together to assist repressive states. And when I say working together, I mean selling weapons, for example. But even in certain cases where, for whatever reason, within the U.S., pressure in Congress, massive bad press against a particular regime, it became impossible for the U.S. to sell weapons to a certain repressive state, Israel would step in and fulfill that role. And that's important because initially, at least, Israel became almost like America's wingman, that, you know, even if America, which sells weapons to pretty much anybody, even if they couldn't sell weapons, Israel would. And pretty much today, just by the way, for listeners, Israel has sold and would sell weapons to pretty much any regime on the planet, democracies and dictatorships, except for a very small percentage. As far as we're aware, it does not sell weapons today to Syria or North Korea or Iran, although it did sell weapons to Iran before the revolution in 1979. So it pretty much sells or would sell weapons to basically any regime on earth, and the US is basically the same. So the Israel US relationship really, I think, deepened hugely in the 70s and 80s to this point. And I have lots of quotes in the book of Israeli officials at the time talking about how they were very happy to be a key American partner in selling defense equipment to repressive regimes. I mean, listeners may find the amorality kind of shocking, but obviously the arms industry was in the past and remains today, if not the most corrupt industry in the world, certainly the second. I mean, the top one probably is drugs and the illegal, you know, transfer of drugs, heroin, cocaine, etc. But the arms industry is up there. I mean, a lot of people estimate, and no one knows exactly, but most people estimate that the levels of corruption in the arms industry, this is across the US, Israel, and beyond, is 40, 50, 60% of that money is bribery and in multiple directions. And Israel is a key player in that. And it seems like when people talk about either the worsening of global conflict or the desire to reduce conflict, unless one seriously deals with the arms industry, you're not going to change a damn thing, right? Because and this is obviously Israel, US, Russia, all the top arms dealers in the world, that they kind of speak and say the right words about believing in human rights and democracy and all those kind of lovely terms, but actually in reality are fueling the conflicts that are making the world a more violent place.
So what about nuclear weapons? I know, you know, Israel possesses nuclear weapons. This is very well known. Does it sell nuclear weapons globally? Is that part of the export of arms coming from Israel?
It's a good question. The short answer is, as far as we know, not really. The exception to that is during apartheid South Africa, which, as I said, ended in 1994, they were very, very close, Israel and South Africa, both as a defense partner, but also ideologically, because they essentially both saw themselves as fighting a war against barbarism, one against black South Africans and one against Palestinians. But during that period, South Africa was very keen to get uranium to build a nuclear weapon, and Israel was assisting them in that process. I mean, the long and the short of it was South Africa was not successful, frankly, thank God, in that process. But look, as far as we're aware, as far as I'm aware in my research, I haven't seen any evidence of Israel selling nuclear weapons to a state. But in some ways, I think what is, well, potentially a danger is the transfer of nuclear technology or uranium, which of course is what you need to build nuclear weapons or even nuclear power. And there has obviously been for a number of years, Saudi Arabia particularly has been flirting with the idea and in fact threatening to build a nuclear weapon if Iran builds a nuclear weapon. And one thing that concerns me moving forward is obviously there is this ongoing instability in the Middle East because of these kinds of issues. And in the recent months when Iran and Saudi Arabia were brought together to make peace by China, which to me was an undeniably good thing. I mean, these are all repressive regimes, let's face it, but certainly it's better to be friends than to be enemies and lowers the tensions in the Middle East, which can only be good. Who do you think opposed that? Israel and the US. They didn't like that at all. And that's relevant because I think for two reasons. One, they see their global hegemony being challenged and they don't like that. But secondly, I think it potentially reduces the options of buying weapons from those states and also shows, of course, the growing emergence of China as a global power. So to answer your question, in short, I don't see evidence of Israel selling huge amounts of nuclear technology or weapons around the world, but that risk is there when Israel has, as far as we're aware, between 200 to 400 nuclear weapons today.
And, you know, and something that you talk about extensively in your work, and we spoke about a little bit earlier, is that how Israel has for more than five decades built an NSA-level system of surveillance across the entire occupied Palestinian territories, such that nowhere is immune from listening, watching, or following, being subjected to this surveillance. Can you talk about in more detail what this NSA level system of surveillance looks like, with the most infamous example being the Israeli repression tech Pegasus?
Absolutely. So as you rightly say, what Israel's constructed over more than five decades is a way to control every aspect of Palestinian life. So every form of communication going in and out. Obviously, back in the day, it was a normal analog phone. Now, of course, it's digital cell phones, so someone's phone or internet. Every form of that communication is monitored, is listened to. is checked. And the reason that's relevant is that it means that all aspects of Palestinian life is controlled. And the unit that's particularly tasked with that is a unit called 8200, which is an Israeli intelligence unit, which its main job 24/7 is to do these pretty grubby jobs of monitoring Palestinian life. And the reason it's relevant to what I wrote about in this book is that when those individuals leave the Israeli military, many, although not all, go into developing tools and technologies, often of repression and weapons, based on the experience they've gained by being in the military and in the intelligence gathering. So you have a huge number of examples, Pegasus being the most infamous, but there are many others, which were founded by Israeli men and women who were in the intelligence services for many years, surveilling Palestinians, making their lives hell. And then when they privatize that, they're doing it really only in name. What I mean by that is many of these tools remain an arm of the state. So when Pegasus, the NSO group is the name of the company, has been selling this spyware around the world in the last roughly 12, 13 years, they're only a private company in name. Netanyahu was prime minister, and the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, go around the world. I'm talking about to nations like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Rwanda, the list goes on. And they're promoting Israeli spyware as a diplomatic carrot. They're saying to those nations, we'd like to be friends with you. This is Israel. We're willing to offer you the most sophisticated spyware in the world that you can use against your own population, your own dissidents, whatever it may be. And what we'd like in return is either acknowledgement that we exist or a certain way of voting in the UN, whatever it may be. And you see in country after country after country, this kind of technology appearing in the use against, as I said, critics or dissidents of those regimes. So Pegasus is the most infamous. There are many, many others. And I think one of the things that's come out in the last few years particularly is that the Biden administration in the US and many other states, although they're nominally friends with Israel, and people would obviously say, well, of course, the US is best friends with Israel, but actually it's more complicated than that. In some ways, they're good friends, but they're also rivals. So when the US in the last few years has tried to censor or curtail the power of companies like Pegasus, actually what they're doing is they're saying it under the guise that we deeply care about this company that's breaching human rights around the world. That's complete nonsense. What they care about is Israeli spyware threatening American spyware dominance. That's what they care about. And to try to curtail Israeli spyware is to challenge the fact that Israeli companies like NSO Group and others have been selling this equipment to dozens and dozens and dozens of countries around the world that gives Israel much more leverage than the US. And as I go into detail in the book, through really quite powerful personal stories, I speak to people who have been surveilled in places like Togo and India and Mexico. And spyware itself is not a weapon that kills you. It's not a gun. But what it does is it completely breaches any sense you have of privacy. Your whole cell phone is controlled. Every text, phone number, photo is captured by the state that has access to Pegasus. Your microphone and your camera on your cell phone can be controlled and used against you, even when the phone is switched off. These are unbelievably powerful tools.
And Anthony, I just, because we're running out of time, please. And I just want to make sure we get to this last question. Sure. As you've been, articulating in your work and through this conversation, nation states are not holding Israel accountable, despite the fact that Israel is contributing to global insecurity and violence around the world, as well as surveillance, like you just described. How can people like myself, those listening, and those who care about human rights and global peace hold Israel accountable? And we just have 30 seconds left. I'm so sorry.
No, I'll make it brief. I think there's a few things very quickly. One can put massive pressure on your local politicians and anyone who's running for politics in the US to actually have a position on this and be opposed to it. We can put pressure on international bodies and the US to have some kind of global regulation or a ban on spyware particularly. And I think it's also raising the issue. I mean, people, shows like yours do that fantastically. But a lot of people simply do not know. Israeli spyware breaches our privacy. And we have the right to privacy as individuals. So I think that's another key way to raise the issue that privacy matters. Encryption matters. We have the right to that as individuals in democratic states.
I'd like to thank our guest, Anthony Lowenstein, an independent journalist, best-selling author, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. His latest book, please go check it out, is The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Thank you so much, Anthony.